You're listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast, making death and dying something we can all talk about.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another Art of Dying Well podcast. Now, I'm delighted to say, I know we do this a lot, but we're going to be talking about the P word, preparation. Now, we always talk about preparing for death, don't we? We're not afraid to talk about death. Every podcast we do, we're happy to talk about death. It is something we should be talking about. But today, the reason I say preparation is there's a word that terrifies me, if I'm honest. Wills. The making of a will. Now, I am going to declare all this. I'm nearly 50. I have 5 children, 3 of them over 18. I don't have a will. I'm sort of overwhelmed when it comes to thinking about having one, worried not to have one. So there you go. There's the equation for you. And I'm joined by someone who I think will not only help me, but might just help you as well. And that's Matthew Hutton, who's the author of an excellent book that's out at the moment called Your Last Gift. And it is as it sounds, actually. But let me tell you a little bit about Matthew, who will tell you about himself as well. Many years as a private client solicitor, set up his own tax consultancy, advising, lecturing and writing books on estate planning and trusts. So we have an expert on our hands here. And on top of that, which I find very interesting, in 2014 was ordained a self-supporting minister in the Church of England. I'm going to first of all say, Matthew, hello, how are you?
Well, it's great to be with you, James. Thank you very much. You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me to join you on this podcast. And I look forward to it.
Yeah, wonderful to have you here. Now, I did declare my fear of wills. I know it's not all about wills, but it's bad I don't have one, isn't it?
It is bad. As you said that, and you confessed that to me before we started, the phrase that came into my mind is, where there's a will, there's a way. And I think it's not a bad little adage, really. So you want to ask me a bit about wills, I guess.
Yes, I certainly want to ask you that question because I think, you know, I don't think it's just me, actually.
No.
And we look at the stats bear out that there is some kind of roadblock here in the way for people who should know better, I hasten to add, when it comes to sorting out a will. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the thought of various taxes, be it capital gains, inheritance, dying intestate. I'd like you to tell us about. I mean, where do we start here for someone that doesn't have a will but is afraid of getting stuck in?
Well, the good news is there's no capital gains tax on death, at least for the time being. There is inheritance tax.
Yeah.
But the statistics are, you're quite right, 3 in every 5 people don't have a will. So you could be sitting around a table, there are 10 people there, and the chances are 6 of them don't have a will. I was always amused that when I was in private practice, the occasion that mostly prompted people coming to see me to make wills was going on holiday. And I thought, well, you know, you're no more likely to die on holiday than you are crossing the road in your local town. So why now? I think there's a host of reasons. Yes, it's fear. It may be, well, I don't own enough, which is not a good reason. It may be a host of other things. It's certainly ignorance of the intestacy provisions. And so if you die without a will, you're called intestate. Yeah. Without a will. And what the law says is that, first of all, if you are married or have a civil partner and no children, then the husband or wife or civil partner takes everything. But if you've got children of any age, then what the spouse or civil partner gets is personal chattels, that's your belongings, what's called the statutory legacy, which is £322,000, plus half of what's left, the residue. And the other half of what's left goes to the children at age 18 in equal shares. And if they've died before you, then it goes to their children, your grandchildren, and so on. And I won't go on to the rules after that. But of course, that could be disastrous because it may mean if you've got quite a lot of cash, valuables, assets, that half of what you've got goes to the children at age 18, which may be quite the wrong thing because they may blow it, they may not handle it responsibly. You may be into inheritance tax, which you could have avoided. But I think the main reason for making a will is that you make a conscious choice as to who's going to look after everything you leave. They're called executors. And it is an important choice, people you trust implicitly. And they will deal with everything. They will exercise any discretions And you can be confident then that your wishes are followed. So you may have a good friend. You may have grown up with somebody and remain friends all your life. You don't necessarily want to give them a cash gift, but you've got a picture or a piece of silver or something that will mean a lot to them. You can write that in your will and so on. So you can die tidily in that sort of sense.
That's the first time I've heard that on this podcast, dying tidily. We're talking about dying well, dying tidily. I'm sure they're interlinked, aren't they? It's a bit of an obvious question, and maybe it is the three in five. Maybe it is people like me. But what inspired you to write the book? Was it a personal experience, or was it looking at this terrain and going, something needs to be done?
What it was late 2019. My wife and I had a group of friends to stay. Two of them had been widowed fairly recently, and one of them in pretty horrendous circumstances, completely unexpectedly. Husband, who was a solicitor, didn't have a will, very fit man, died abroad. And she had really a terrible year as a result. And the other one, whose husband was a very great friend of mine, very tragically died of dementia, aged about 70. And they had some time to get things in order. But what she said to me, "Matthew, if you write something, it will be a real gift to those you leave behind," hence the title of the book. And a number of other people present then agreed with that, others since then. I'm a late developer, slow learner, so it took me till December 2022 to write the thing. But it was that prompting, and also I think my professional background as a lawyer, my pastoral background as a priest in terms of taking funerals, preparing people for death and so on, which said to me, I think, well, you're in quite a good place to write this. So encouraged by others, I got on with it.
And what I like about it, actually, is that I like your style, by the way, and I think that's important if you want people to engage with the book. You have to be able to write well, and that's certainly the case here. But it covers those practical matters. We've just scratched at the surface of wills and other things, finances, possessions, funeral planning. But then the importance of relationships, leaving a legacy, and importantly, finding meaning at the end of life. I'm quite interested that you mix the sort of philosophical as well. Well, yeah. How did that come about?
I mean, it is fundamentally intended to be practical. I mean, there's a host of really good books about grief and bereavement. And I've got a list of 20, 25 books at the end, which I've found jolly useful. But it seemed to me that there was a gap in the market. There wasn't anything that brought together in the space of about 120 pages. As I say, it's concise, but relatively comprehensive. All the practical stuff, which, if you're bereaved for the first time of somebody close to you and you find you have to do all these things, it comes as a complete shock. And you're trying to nurse this intense, profound feeling within you that stays with you forever. But at the same time, you've got His Majesty's Revenue and Customs and other people knocking on your door, and you need to get on with it. So the idea is for each of us, and it doesn't matter what age we are, because, for example, if we've got young children and, you know, if both parents go, you need to think about guardians for them. It doesn't matter how rich you are, but it's just getting your affairs in order. That's the subtitle of the book, and that's why it's so important. And you mentioned relationships, and very intentionally, I'm a bit of a nerd, I'm afraid, when it comes to sort of language. So all the chapters begin with the letter P. And chapter 3 on people intentionally comes before chapter 4 on possessions, because I think it's so much more important to get our relationships right, both over the rest of our lives. And by the time you die, you don't want there to be any unfinished business. So I talk about forgiveness, and I think whether asking or receiving. And I think that's a very important prerequisite to being able to die in peace.
Well, it chides very well with what we try and achieve at The Art of Dying Well, actually. And the P thing, I wish I'd spotted that. I'm kicking myself a bit.
including the word preface. Preface followed by six Ps. There you are.
Very, very good. Very clever. I am going to plug the website for the book, not only because you can get hold of a copy via the website or information as to how to do so, but also, you know, you are a stickler, I can tell, and the law changes and there are updates and you know, we've got some useful checklists and practicalities, as you've mentioned in the book. But you can get more information, up-to-date information, at www.yourlastgiftbook.com. That's all one, isn't it?
That's right. And the point about the website is obviously that it tells you about the book. It enables you to buy a hard copy. It enables you to buy a digital version. But there is an updates tab. And so any significant changes in the law, for example, last year, I mentioned the statutory legacy of £322,000. It went up last July from £270,000. So that I noted. And any significant changes in the law will go down there. I brought out the second edition on the 12th of March, and I've got the content of all the changes between the first and the second. So if you bought the first edition and you think, why didn't I wait for the second? Well, actually, all the new content is there, so you can find that for yourself and feel you haven't been shortchanged. But yes, you're right, and if you'll allow me to lead into this, the whole purpose of the book is to take you towards these checklists. There are two checklists, a critical checklist and a comprehensive checklist, and then five forms which you are encouraged to download, or now we produced a booklet, a hard copy booklet you can buy at extra cost and fill in, keep updated, and leave somewhere secure. So that really is the gift. That's the gift in physical form or in digital form, that you are leaving those who will come after you to be able to deal with officialdom and all the practical stuff in a sensible and, I hope, as painless as possible sort of way.
Especially for the reluctant many, myself included. I must admit, just to pick up on something you said before, it's interesting when you were talking about the friends and you talked about the solicitor without a will. Yes. I mean, that really is quite something, isn't it? I mean, I'm not saying that I'm not fully culpable, but a solicitor without a will?
Well, funny enough, and I forget his name, but the author, it was, you know, I remember as we were studying law, it was well said that the author of one of the leading textbooks on wills himself died intestate. So he didn't exactly practice what he preached.
Why do you think that this three in five exists? Is it because people think they've got more time than they actually have? I mean, what are the reasons?
Yeah, it's partly that. I mean, there's another very interesting statistic. So the Christian think tank Theos published in November 2023 a very significant report called Love, Grief and Hope. And in it, they said that 25% of us, adults in the UK, think about our own death at least once a week, which I think is astonishing. I mean, it's not exactly a topic of polite society, but it does mean that it's there in the background.
Mm.
And what I find it extraordinary, I mean, you started off with the other P word, preparation. You know, we prepare, we make plans for where we're going to work, who we're going to marry or live with, whether or not we're going to have children, jobs, pastimes, holidays, and so on. But the one thing traditionally we don't prepare for is the ultimate certainty. And I think it's curious, it's irresponsible. We're meant to be called homo sapiens. I'm a classicist, wise mankind. But we're really very, very stupid in that respect. People talk about practical things, how society works, the tax system, healthcare, whatever it is. But we could add into that something about the law, something about wills, not to frighten people, but just to say, look, you know, once you get to 18, this is something you ought to be thinking about.
And those of us spiritually minded people, it's almost less of an excuse because we should be looking beyond this life anyway. So it is a rather a bizarre blind spot.
Well, yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's all very well to say, you know, yes, we're thinking of heaven after we die. But actually, it is irresponsible to leave things in a mess when we have the power to get it right.
But do you think people wait for a diagnosis? They're not expecting the bus to hit them in the face, are they?
Well, there's another interesting, we are talking about stats, interesting statistic that the number of people who die unexpectedly is about 23-24%. Over three quarters of us have time to prepare.
Yeah.
And it may be, yes, you've had a terminal diagnosis. And of course, doctors traditionally, and you can't blame them for this, you know, never like putting time spans on it. But, you know, it may be 3 months, maybe 6 months, however long it is, or it may be old age or, you know, whatever it is. But you have got time to do something. And one of the points about my critical checklist as opposed to my comprehensive checklist is looking at what I call the three essentials. And the three essentials, I would say something we haven't yet talked about before yet, is lasting powers of attorney, second is wills, and third is funeral arrangements. And on funeral arrangements, I've found when taking funerals, if the person who's gone has actually set out in some detail what they would like to happen, and if it's a Christian ceremony, hymns, readings, who they'd like to take part, what they'd like to happen afterwards in the terms of a party, which incidentally is inheritance tax deductible, then the family is so much more at ease because that pressure is taken off them and they're arranging the funeral in the way that they know he or she would have wanted. Whether you want to be buried, whether you want to be cremated, if buried where, if cremated where ashes scattered and so on.
I think we should talk about lasting powers of attorney.
Lasting powers of attorney. So if you get to the point where you are no longer able to look after yourself, so mental incapacity, it may be dementia, maybe some physical reason, whatever it is, then if you don't, it's rather like dying intestate, if you don't have lasting powers of attorney, in other words, if you haven't appointed the people you want to look after your affairs, and there are two, there's property and financial affairs on the one hand, there's health and welfare on the other, very often the same personal people will be attorneys under both, then what's called the court of protection takes over. And you really do not want to go to the court of protection because it takes ages, it's expensive, and so much better to set it out beforehand. You can do it yourself, you can get a solicitor to do it for you. Once made, you register them with the office of the public guardian, put them in a drawer. You may never need them, but if you do, there they are. And so it's essential people should have those. There's something called an advance decision, which has the force of law. It's signed before a witness. The NHS call it a living will. You'll have heard that expression. Yeah. And that sets out your wishes. It's very important. And, you know, you can't blame the medical profession, can you? But, you know, if you don't want to be kept alive, it's much better that you're allowed simply to slip away. The big thing, obviously, you know, you want pain to be controlled, and pretty much they're able to do that now. But I think as time goes on, as you're left with, and you don't know what it is, but months, weeks, days, then you say, well, actually, ideally, this is where I'd like to be. This is how I'd like to spend that time.
And funeral planning? I mean, you know, there's so many ways these days that one could be buried, cremated. I mean, very eco-conscious things. There are many things, aren't there?
Well, not so many ways. One thing I have got in my book, because I want to lighten it up a bit. I've got a series of quotations. I've also got some rather fun cartoons. Mm. And one of the cartoons has the vicar at the graveside with the pallbearers putting the coffin down. And on top of the coffin is coming fire. And the caption is, they didn't specify which, so we wanted to cover both bases. So, yeah, you say what and where. What's quite interesting, again, this has been reported recently by the insurance company Sun Life, is the typical costs of burials, cremations, and what is called direct cremations. Direct cremations are much cheaper.
Yeah.
And interestingly, over 2023, 20% of all funerals were direct cremations. And that may be a matter of not being able to afford it. But what happens with a direct cremation is nobody is present apart from the funeral director. And then the family are handed the ashes afterwards.
Because I think you had a sliding scale of sort of roughly 1,500 for that, 3,000 for a cremation, and just over 5 for a burial. I didn't even know they were the figures. I mean, they're significant, aren't they? And it's worth planning for that eventuality.
Yeah, and there are funeral plans you can take out, you can provide that. The other interesting thing, which I've got involved with recently, is what happens if there is no money at all.
Mm.
And what used to be called pauper's funerals, which is rather an unfortunate expression, is that they're now called public health funerals. And the council will then bury the person in an unmarked grave in the cemetery. And I got rather exercised by this, particularly with somebody in our congregation at church, because what happens if you have somebody who was a Christian to have the body put down unceremoniously, a couple of sentences spoken by the council officer, and thinking of the sanctity of life and the preciousness of life. And so what I arranged with the council is that where there was evidence of a Christian faith, then they would allow an ordained person or a authorised layperson to take a ceremony at the graveside. And I've done a couple of these and other people have done them. And it's very, very moving. And you have sort of 15, 20 people. You're not limited too much by time. You've got to get the timing right as far as the council is concerned. But you can build in space for tributes in the same way as a formal funeral. And it's very moving. So I don't know what happens in other parts of the country, but it would be really nice if that sort of religious aspect of public health funerals could be developed.
Yeah, and not subject to having the money, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Art of Dying Well podcast is available on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Just search on your preferred platform.
We talk about the P's that start each chapter. People. Mm. Can we talk about Debbie quickly, Deborah, your sister?
Yeah.
Because you do reference her book, actually, in this, What Can I Do to Help? 75 Practical Ideas for Family and Friends from Cancer's Frontline. So I think, first of all, tell us about Deborah. Tell us what she faced. And
well, Debbie, she died far too young, age 49, of lung cancer. She had 8 months from diagnosis to death. And interestingly, she rang me. It was I just got home, November 2004, and told me the grim news, stage 4 cancer, and said, I've got to sort out two things. I've got to sort out my will and my relationship with God, having kept God at arm's length all her life. So I said, I think we can deal with both those. Okay. And I wasn't directly involved, but I pointed her to a really good church, Christ Church Highbury. There was a wonderful vicar called Jonathan Brewster. And I said to Debbie, we'll go and, you know, knock on his door. And she said, well, you know, I feel a bit of a fraud having kept God at arm's length. And I said, well, think of it from Jonathan's point of view. Here you are, knocking on a vicar's door saying, tell me about God. And she did, and joined the church. And she came to a real faith in February 2005. She died in July and died in full assurance of faith. And this, she'd been a journalist. She was health editor of Vogue. I think her first book, Complete Beauty, sorry, this is not an ad for Complete Beauty, but I think it was one of Octopus's bestsellers. We were in Peru and saw a copy there.
Wow.
But as she was dying, and this quotation of hers that I put in the book, I'm not dying of cancer, I'm living with cancer. And that's so important. My book's a book about life, not about death. She wrote this book, What Can I Do to Help? And she was very well connected with all sorts of celebs. And she went round to them and said, you know, what are your thoughts on this? And put them all in the book. And it's a great book because too often, you know, and we're all the same, aren't we, really? If you see somebody who's been recently bereaved and you sort of sounds all, you know, you cross the street, you sort of, because you don't know
it's
what
hard
to say.
Yeah,
you
is.
Don't know what to
yeah.
say.
Yeah.
And I think the key thing, you know, however close you are to somebody, the key thing is being with somebody.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what to say, keep your trap shut. And take your lead from them. And if they want to talk, they'll talk. If they want you to talk, they'll ask a question. And if they don't want you to be with them, they'll just say, you know, sorry, would you mind? And that's fine. But I think making yourself available to people who are going through it or who've just been bereaved is so important.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, obviously nearly 20 years on since Debbie died, it brings me to that word legacy a bit, because writing a book does leave a legacy, especially a book that is designed, if you like, to help people face what they're facing, like your book. You know, we all, whether we're in rude health or we've had potentially a terminal diagnosis. I mean, how important do you think it is that we sort of take on that end of life planning?
Yeah, well, I think it's very, I mean, the trouble about legacy is, of course, people think, well, you have to be terribly rich or famous or whatever, but you don't. And legacy is, of course, a technical term for something that you leave somebody in your will. But much more generally, and your question brings this up, you talk about legacy as something that you leave behind. It's memories, it's relationships. Yes, it could be something physical. I mean, it's said of people, everybody's got a book in them. I mean, you may not feel, listening to this, that you're the writing sort of person, but you can leave something in writing. You can leave photographs. And the thing about photographs is, don't be like me, who hasn't sorted out his photographs yet. That's something I've got to do. But you can leave some photographs. You can leave some account of your life. And by that, I don't mean things like O-level results. That dates me aged 70, now GCSE and A-levels. You know, but experiences, things that mattered to you, people you met, that sort of thing, I think is important. And, you know, my father died far too young, 1984. Mum died 2010. But it's lovely when you come across people that you don't really know and they say, well, I knew him, I knew her. This is how I remember them. And very often you have funny stories. And we need to be able to laugh as well. And, yeah, and laughter and crying are very sort of closely related. The other thing about... I'm British. If you're listening to this and you're British, then, you know, traditionally we're quite reserved as a race. And we're talking about, in a sense, getting up close and personal, being quite intimate. And we sort of shy away from intimacy. But I think it's important because relationships and close relationship, and of course, supremely, if you're a believer, your relationship with God, it's something that's profoundly intimate. And I think as human beings, we're called, you know, God made us in his own image. We're called to model that in our relationships with other people.
Yeah.
And when, you know, we all get frightfully excited at the birth and celebration and et cetera, and none of us know when death is going to happen. And yes, and sometimes it is tragic. It is far too young, as it was with Debbie, but she left lots of memories behind. But if we can do what we can to make that experience as good as possible, then not only is it good for us, it's good for those who are close to us.
Well, we were talking a little bit off mic about Professor Catherine Mannix and her wonderful work in palliative care, and also her skills as an author, you know, really does chide with what we're talking about here. And I remember that first book with the end in mind. I kind of almost want to ask you that question, because I look at your life and it's been so varied. You have declared your age at around about 70. I don't think I mentioned farmer in the intro, which is interesting because we've got, we've got vicar, farmer, tax lawyer, a lecturer, studied classics at university. And yet you've also talked about your sister, your father, who died prematurely. Has death always been on your mind? Has the end been on your mind? Because it strikes me that through all these experiences, there's an awful lot of looking at the end.
Yeah, well, not much. I mean, I suppose...
Possibly not in farming, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. You have the seasons, I suppose.
That's true.
But no, I don't think it has. And I don't think myself as morbid. I'd like to think of myself as realistic and as being able to help people. And of course, you know, if you have some, with it a denomination or a community of faith, if you have some sort of responsibility which involves you, and I don't limit this to the Christian faith but or to the Anglican Church, but if you have that position, that responsibility, it's a huge privilege. Almost there's none greater. And again, we were joking before we started, and I was saying, and I've said to Catherine Mannix, when I go, I'd love to book you. But I think there'll be a long list of
I'm
people.
I'm in that queue, steady.
But I think, you know, when the time comes for each of us, it would be lovely not only to be in that close relationship with God, if we have that faith, but also with those around us. And I noticed this with my mother. I mean, she died aged 82. And over the last year, she lived in Norfolk on the farm, and her horizons gradually narrowed down. And, you know, she didn't want to go to London. She didn't want to drive and see friends, wanted them to come to her. And then as the end approached, and I went round every evening over the last week and prayed with her and read the Bible to her, that she wanted her very close family to be with her. And that's what you try to respect, and that's what, you know, I'd like for me.
Is it that narrowing and narrowing to the things that really are important?
I think so. I think so. And you know, we're all different. We all have different lives. We do different things. Mm. I mean, that's the great thing about the human race, however many billion of us, eight or so, and however many have lived. You know, every single one is different. But I think we can relate to each other. We can relate to strangers.
Yeah.
You know, things like smiles, or as somebody did yesterday as my wife and I got off the train from Norwich, you know, helped her with her case off the train. You know, a little, you know, a tiny act of kindness.
Yes.
And the more that we can be kind to each other and relate to each other, you know, we don't have to have death in mind. And I don't, I mean, I suppose professionally, I mean, since I became qualified as a solicitor in 1979, yes, I did corporate tax, then I did private client tax, and that was trusts and wills and inheritance tax. So inevitably, you're dealing with that.
But you do make that important point that, and it's in the book,
yeah,
that it's not about being morbid.
No.
Which is very fair. But I'll rephrase ever so slowly, because I think I'm barking up the wrong tree ever so slowly. In terms of you, I know you've written this for other people, but is there any element of it that you've written for yourself, or what have you learnt along the way?
You've made your confession to me, James. I have to make my confession to you, which is I have yet got to do quite a bit of decluttering, because I think my wife and I plan to downsize over the next couple of years. And of course, the interesting thing about decluttering is you know, your children don't necessarily want what you've got. Brown furniture, for example. I think too many of us have too much stuff, so I need to get rid of that. I think I was putting down, and yes, in one sense, I was writing for myself and other people, but I think I was putting down what I already felt. I mean, I don't think I was sort of converted yeah. as I wrote the book. I think I'd already been converted to this, and then the book came out of that. In a sense, I thought rather like my tax books. All I had to do was write the book, and that was it. And all I had to do was write the book. But then what I found afterwards, coming across The Art of Dying Well, the local hospice, other organisations, that there's a connection. And I think these connections are brilliant. I mean, the first week of May, Dying Matters all over the country, in Norwich, I'll be there, I was there last year. And you meet a host of different people who are all involved in this in different ways. And I think sort of working together is so important. So I wouldn't call it a mission, but it's something that speaks very powerfully to me inside. And so opportunities to speak about it. And I'm, you know, not just selling the book, but you know, I don't speak about it without mentioning the book.
Yeah.
I mean, amusingly enough, I've been asked to give a lecture at the Chartered Institute of Taxation's annual conference, which, you know, I used to lecture for the Chartered Institute of Taxation. I'm a fellow. I was rather chuffed to be invited to come along and speak. I mean, not so much about the book, but the book gets mentioned, but the whole subject, you know, along with very heavy duty stuff on stamp duty, land tax and corporate taxation and that sort of thing. In a sense, what I will be saying to people, yes, this is for the benefit of your clients, but actually it's for the benefit of all of us. All of us need to sit up and take notice. So it has become something of a, I'll use the word mission. There you are.
Lovely. I managed to squeeze that out of you. I've been trying for 40 minutes. No, I'm only joking. Well, look, I'm glad you availed yourself of this opportunity to talk about the wonderful book, Your Last Gift. It is very helpful. It is for me and others like me. I do feel chastised. I mean, you even used the word irresponsible. So that's ringing in my ears. No, well, I mean, not unfairly. So that's ringing in my ears. I do want to give that little reminder, www.yourlastgiftbook.com, where you can get a copy. And also, as I say, those updates and further resources. You did declare the financial interest, but I think it's not all about the money, otherwise you wouldn't have provided these free resources as an update for those that bought the first edition and because you obviously care. So final question. People like me, others like me, if you were just to focus them back, just to, like you said with your mum, just to narrow them back in, what is the principal message they should take away?
I think that one day we're going to die. and that we do, while we are of sound mind and fit, whatever age we are, we have the power, we have the opportunity to make things easier for those who are going to follow after us. It doesn't have to be reading my book. It could be a host of other ways. There are other people writing about it. But however you do it, take it seriously, take time, have fun over it. I mean, one of the things I put in this latest edition is if there's a couple of you, then very often, you know, one of you will be engaged with one lot of stuff, and I won't be genderist, but whether it's sort of cooking or whether it's, you know, financial affairs, and you don't know who's going to go first, we'll start sharing. Mm. Sort of make sure both of you do a bit of cooking, both of you do the financial affairs. So I say it can be fun as well. What you don't want, there are sort of famous last words, aren't there? And I've got some of those in my book, like Spike Milligan, I told you I was ill. But, you know, what you don't want your last thought to be is, I wish I had got my affairs in order and I haven't.
Well, that's a good way to end. And as I say, it shall ring in my ears. Now you've got the cooking ringing in my ears. I'm useless
and
at
mine,
that. Useless
mine.
At that as well. But no, that's really good. A really good practical point as well. Share some of those things. Yeah. Don't just leave it to someone else. You might not get the opportunity. Mm. Listen, Matthew, thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming in. And without the desire to go plug heavy, yourlastgiftbook.com, people, if you want to get a copy, and I'd certainly advise that. And those, you know, those important checklists are there. But more importantly, continue that conversation on death. Don't wait until tomorrow. Today's a good day to do it. So crack on with that. And thank you so much. Safe journey and stay in touch, please.
Yeah. Thank you, James. Will do. Bye-bye.
Thank you.